Oh, good. I'm glad I have a little bit of a fan club here. So, good evening, everyone. My name is Maxwell Brandon, and I have the honor of serving as chairman of the Young Americans for Freedom chapter here at the University of Southern California. Yeah, fight on. We're excited to have you all here with us tonight. It took a lot of planning. We're glad everyone's here. So when we were founded in September 2017, we're just over a year old, we became part of an organization whose history dates back to 1960 and whose reach stretches to over 450 college campuses throughout the United States. YAF is dedicated to preserving and promoting the principles that define American exceptionalism. Among them are the beliefs in a limited government, free enterprise, individual responsibility, and a strong national defense. Since our founding, we've hosted speakers to address the misconceptions of socialism, the modern plantation of the government welfare state, and engaged in conversations and debates with numerous individuals and organizations ranging from issues of race relations to gun control. And for those interested, we meet every Thursday night at 6:30 in Tabor Hall of Humanities, and give us that follow on Facebook at USCYAF. Over the past year, we have been asked one question consistently, or an array of questions consistently. Are you guys bringing Ben Shapiro? Think you'll ever get Ben Shapiro? Or my personal favorite, when are you going to bring him? Assuming we would know who him was, and we were well aware of who him was, and we're glad to say the time is now because he's here with us tonight. So I'm not done talking yet. You got to deal with me for a little bit more. So before bringing Ben out, there are quite a few people we have to thank. We owe them our sincere gratitude. So I'd like to start by thanking Young America's Foundation, our parent org, and especially Mr. Fred Allen. Their dedication to the conservative movement has not only made this event possible, but hundreds of others like it on high school and college campuses across the United States. I'd also like to thank our donors seated in the front of the room for making our event possible, making sure all our costs were covered. I'd also like to thank the school and the Department of Public Safety for ensuring that our not only we're protected, but our rights are protected of those both inside and outside the event. And finally, I want to thank you all for coming tonight, all 1,200 of you, especially those in the audience who disagree with us. We truly, you can clap. We truly appreciate you coming to have a debate with us tonight, bringing an open mind, and we really look forward to hearing your questions at the latter half of this event. So now a little bit about Ben, not that you guys don't already know everything about him. Ben Shapiro is editor-in-chief of TheDailyWire.com and the host of The Ben Shapiro Show, the top conservative podcast. The top conservative podcast in the nation. Shapiro is the author of 7 books, including the New York Times bestseller, Bullies, How the Left's Culture of Fear and Intimidation Silences America. Shapiro is also a nationally syndicated columnist, as he has been since age 17. He's not a perfect man. He's a graduate of UCLA. He's also a graduate of Harvard Law, but that should give you confidence. Something decent does come out of Harvard Law. And as Rush Limbaugh says, Shapiro isn't just content to be dazzled by, isn't content to have people dazzled by his brilliance. He actually goes out and confronts and tries to persuade, mobilize, and motivate people. And obviously, that's worked out very well. Glenn Beck calls Shapiro a warrior for conservatism against those who use fear and intimidation to stifle honest debate. I've never known him to back down from a fight. We saw the security tonight. He definitely doesn't shy away from people looking to shut him down. And Sean Hannity says to join Ben Shapiro and fight back against liberal bullying. Even the liberal Washington... Even the liberal Washington Post, in the aftermath of Ben Shapiro's devastating destruction of Piers Morgan on national television... Which, if you haven't seen that video, you should really watch that video. The Washington Post conceded that Shapiro is a foe of extraordinary polemical agility. And for those of you that didn't know, his wife's a doctor. So without further ado, please welcome Mr. Ben Shapiro.
Thank you all for coming. Thank you for braving the wilds outside. And I'm glad folks decided not to disrupt tonight. I mean, the night is young yet. Well, we'll see. But I am very excited to be here. I'd first like to give a special thanks to the Young Americas Foundation chapter here at USC, who's done amazing work in making sure this event could actually take place. I want to thank the administration for ensuring that, despite all the hardships, this could all happen. I especially want to thank the law enforcement officers for doing what they had to do to ensure that this event could take place in safety and security. Law enforcement is wildly underappreciated, and everything they do is done to make us safe. I'd also like to give a special thanks to Fred Allen for making this event possible. He sponsors events like these across college campuses, and Mr. Allen has proven himself to be a great advocate for free speech and America's founding principle. I do have a lot of warmth, I should say, for USC. I have a bunch of family members who are USC grads. My sister went here. Two of my sisters-in-law actually went to grad school here. I have a bunch of friends who went here. And while this is the inferior school in town, I will acknowledge that I may only be saying that because I went to the public school. So while I do have a soft spot for USC, and my sister literally graduated about 200 feet from here from the opera program, I can see that a lot of Trojans don't necessarily have a soft spot for me. I was noticing some folks chanting outside. Apparently, I am a racist, a bigot, a homophobe, and all the rest of the litany. I'm also a neo-Nazi, which makes the yarmulke real weird. I'm apparently in favor of genocide, which was a new one. I am also in favor of violence. They were chanting outside that speech is violence, which is weird because they all seem to be standing just fine, even as I speak. All of this is sheer nonsense and garbage. I'm happy to respond to any such accusations. It's also worth noting that despite all of the hubbub over this particular speech, it's not like USC has no history of inviting controversial speakers, which is good. I mean, they should invite controversial speakers. But they've had radical feminist Gloria Steinem, and Senator Barbara Boxer, legitimately the stupidest woman in the history of the United States Senate. Immigration radical Jose Antonio Vargas spoke here. And apparently, what's weird to me is that I'm apparently like a lot more controversial than Angela Davis, who is an actual Stalinist, who once allegedly funneled guns to criminals, and then the criminals actually used those guns to murder a judge. But the good news is that Angela Davis is welcome on this campus, but it takes a hell of a lot to get me here. I'm hearing that some of the protesters are accusing Yaf and me tonight of racism because apparently some folks were not allowed to come. I guess the claim went like this, that there were some people who tried to buy tickets and then they weren't allowed to come, or at least they tried to claim tickets for free, and then weren't allowed to come. And this was based on race. This, of course, is total crap. Let me correct the record. The only people who were barred from coming were people who were openly stating on social media they plan to disrupt the event in advance. It is not the responsibility of YAF to sponsor people who want to come and disrupt an event that YAF is sponsoring. That's absurd. There were people who bought tickets under names like You're a Nazi and No Hate Speech. Some students posted on social media were trying to reserve as many tickets as possible to shut it down. Note to protesters, if you're going to do this sort of op, you might not want to broadcast it on social media, you dopes. So these leftists are suggesting that such a ban on self-stated disruptors is racial profiling, which obviously it is not. Idiots come in all different colors. I mean, the people protesting outside who are expressing their First Amendment rights, and I'm glad that they are, I don't think it speaks well of their intelligence, but those people come in every race and size and creed and gender, all 93 of them. And I do, for people who disagree, I have a standing policy. We do a long Q&A section here at my speeches, and people who disagree raise their hand, they immediately go to the front of the line. So I'm more than happy to have a conversation with anyone who wants to have a conversation with me. What I'm not happy about is anyone who tries to prevent others from hearing that conversation. I'm very happy that that is not taking place tonight, again, thanks to security and USC for doing what they are supposed to do. So tonight, I want to talk a little bit about your freedoms and why they are under assault. They're under assault from a variety of groups, from motivated thinkers on a bunch of political sides, but most of all, they are under assault from advocates of identity politics, people who believe that their version of social justice should override individual rights. These are the folks who are really dangerous to your rights. Now, to understand the current assault on individual rights, we first have to understand there are two contrasting visions of rights in the United States and in the West generally. So one vision of rights is the negative rights vision. The negative rights vision basically says that rights come from God. They are inalienable, they come from God or nature, as expressed in the Declaration of Independence. They are self-evident, and these are the rights that you would have in a state of nature, meaning you and your family live somewhere without a government. What are the rights that you have as a human being in the absence of a government? So, for example, you have a right to self-defense, you have a right to free speech. Nobody is allowed to actually infringe on those freedoms because in a state of nature, if somebody tried to do that, you would defend yourself from that sort of imposition. Those are negative rights. Then there's another vision of rights. These are positive rights. So positive rights are rights that come from government. The idea is that there are no rights outside of a collective that gives you the right. So if you have a right to property, that's only because the government is letting you have property. If you have a right to free speech, it's only because the government allows you to speak freely. But all rights, in the end, only come from the collective. They only come from government. There are no pre-existing individual rights in a state of nature or anything like that. Negative rights are rights that you have from the intervention of others. Positive rights are rights that you have from the goods and services of others. So, for example, I have a right to defend my own life. I have a right to self-defense. That is a negative right because it's a right to defend my life from the imposition of others. A positive right is the idea that you have a right to walk into my store and demand a service of me. That's a positive right because you really don't have that right in a state of nature. I'd get to make a contract with you. If you chose to make that contract with me, then we'd have a deal. But you don't have a right to my services. Positive rights suggest that you do have a right to stuff from me. So, for example, a right to health care requires that there be a doctor that you can force care from. When people say right to health care, that means a good or service coming from someone who is not you, and your right is an imposition of a duty on someone else. Someone else now has a duty to do something for you that they would not otherwise have a duty to do. The problem is, you see, with positive rights is that they are not self-fulfilling. A right to self-defense is self-fulfilling. Somebody tries to kill me, I defend myself. That is a self-fulfilling right. A positive right is not self-fulfilling. I have a right to health care. Well, what if there's no one who actually wants to take care of me for free? Well then, presumably, because I have positive rights, I get to stick my gun in their face and tell them that they ought to care for me for free. Okay, positive rights are only compulsory. Positive rights are compelled. Positive rights views often conflict with negative rights views, as you can see. I want to defend my life. I want to defend my right to liberty of contract. You want to force me to care for you. So a negative rights view and a positive rights view are now in conflict. The United States is based on negative rights. It is not based on positive rights. The U.S. Constitution is based on negative rights. The Constitution of, say, South Africa is based on positive rights. The French Declaration of the Rights of Man is based on positive rights, like the right to housing, the right to food, the right to medical care. None of this is in the United States Constitution because the Constitution doesn't believe that you have the right to take the collective and use the collective gun against me to force me to give you services. The U.S. Constitution is specifically designed to undercut regimes of positive rights. That's what the Constitution is designed to do. You know, the part of the Constitution nobody talks about, the structural Constitution, the part that matters the most, you know, Articles 1, 2, and 3, and all the rest, all of those articles are all about checks and balances designed to prevent people from leveraging power against you. The idea is that if there's a majority that wants to leverage power against you here, well, there's going to be another majority in the states that are going to stop you. There's a majority in the Senate that will be checked by a majority in the Congress. There's a majority in both houses of Congress that will be checked by the president. Checks and balances were designed to stop tyranny of the majority. This is obvious from the Federalist Papers. It's obvious from the text of the Constitution. It's no surprise, then, because the Constitution is based on a philosophy of negative rights, that it has come under dire attack from advocates of positive rights. These positive rights advocates in the United States happen to be on the political left, which makes sense. Many on the left, or leftist philosophy, is not about belief in God. It's about belief in government. It's not about the belief in individuals and rights that accrue to you as individual. It's about the power of the collective, what we can do together. Right? As Barack Obama said in 2012 at the DNC, as the Democratic National Convention put up on their big platform, the only thing that we all have in common is the government. Now, these positive rights advocates in the United States on the left, they've gone one step further. They actually suggest that positive rights ought to accrue not on the basis of individual identity. It's not that you have a positive right to health care. They ought to accrue on the basis of identity group. They say that intersectionality, meaning the overlapping experiences we all have as members of different groups, right? You have an experience as a black person that's different from the experience of a white person. You have an experience as a woman that's different from the experience that you have as a man. So a black woman has a different experience than a white man, right? This idea means that as a member of these different groups, there's a hierarchy of ability to exercise your positive rights in this supposedly discriminatory system. So whites have more rights in the view of intersectionality theorists than black people do. Women have fewer rights than men do. So you have this sort of hierarchy of discrimination, according to a lot of folks on the left. And therefore, the government has to act collectively to protect the positive rights of these various groups. In this view, negative rights, a regime that says we are all individuals who are free, and we're not members of groups, we're all individuals with individual rights. In the positive rights view, in the leftist view, negative rights reinforce existing hierarchies and thus must be overturned. Negative rights are the obstacle to freedom in this particular view. So under the auspices of identity politics, the folks outside chanting about their group identity, under those auspices, their belief is that the entire negative rights infrastructure, the Constitution of the United States, individual rights, this all must be torn down by the collective in favor of a more just distribution of positive rights. It's something that makes the world more equal, something that ensures that all groups are treated fairly. Now, there's only one problem with this. Group justice does not actually mean justice. Social justice does not mean justice. Individual justice means justice. You want to be treated as an individual because you are an individual. We don't want any group discriminated against, but that's because we believe in individuals, not groups. The idea that we are supposed to rejigger the hierarchy by obliterating the individual, that individuals don't matter anymore. Instead, we're going to judge you based on your group identity, and then we're going to decide who gets rights and who doesn't, is actually an evil philosophy. But that philosophy is now being pushed by many folks on the left. So here's how this plays out in terms of your actual down-to-earth rights. The Bill of Rights contains 10 amendments originally, explicitly guaranteeing your negative rights. It's all about negative rights. There are no real positive rights in the Bill of Rights. Those amendments list a bevy of negative rights. Virtually all of them are currently being undermined by the political left in this country. And I want to go through a few of these key rights tonight and show you how the political left is attempting to destroy your rights, attempting to destroy you as an individual in favor of their collectivist utopian schemes for making the world a fairer place. So the First Amendment guarantees freedom of religion. The Constitution says, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. This is not two separate clauses. People read this as two separate clauses, that there is one clause that says that we shouldn't establish religion, and then there's a second clause that says we should not prohibit the free exercise of religion. It's one clause. What the Constitution means is we should not establish a national religion so that we are not cramming down anything on your religion. The idea of religious freedom is inherent in the idea of being an individual, right? There's an individual negative right. I have a right to worship. Okay. But the left maintains that even if you're bothering no one, their positive rights regime demands that your negative rights be made secondary. So a few examples. You're a religious baker, and you believe that you ought to be able to conduct your business as you see fit. This is your negative right. It's your business. It's nobody else's business. They didn't put the time in. They didn't put the money in. You get to deal with who you want to. That's a basic freedom. It's an associative freedom, not just a religious freedom. As we'll see, the Constitution also says you get to associate with who you want. The government doesn't get to force association upon you. The left says, no, we will force you to violate your religion because we believe that you have a right to walk into anybody's shop and order anything you want, and it is their job to provide it to you. So if you walk into a religious Christian shop and you want a cake for your same-sex wedding, well, we will force you at point of gun, at point of bayonet. We'll fine you. We'll destroy your life if you don't do that. This is a violation of fundamental freedoms. Now, for those of you in the room who are saying, well, why don't you just bake the cake? Okay, fine, you open a bakery and you bake the cake. It's not up to you to decide what anybody else does with their shop. It's not up to you to decide what anybody else does with their school. If you believe that you get to tell somebody what they do with their business on this level, then this makes you the tyrant in this situation. Just because you disagree with someone doesn't mean you have the right to oppress them. Okay, another example with regard to freedom of religion. Obamacare required originally that all health care plans cover abortion care. And this meant that the federal government tried to tell a nunnery, the Little Sisters of the Poor, that they had to cover at least minor abortion care. The basic idea was that they had to fill out a form saying they didn't cover abortion care, which would then trigger a government provision of abortion care. The Little Sisters of the Poor, as you might tell from their name, it's a bunch of nuns. Nuns are not famous for their advocacy for the killing of the unborn. And yet Obamacare, nonetheless, was attempting to force these nuns into a system of guaranteeing abortion care for people. This is a violation of individual rights of nuns, and if they can come for a religion that is not yours, they can certainly come for a religion that is yours. This is true with regard to mandates on the behavior of those you hire or fire, your religious school. And your religious school teaches that there are two sexes, not nine, not 13, not attack helicopters, two. Okay? And as the head of a religious school, you say, look, we teach kindergartners. We teach kids who are five. And we really don't want Miss Sally to come in tomorrow and be Mr. Jim. Right? That's not something that we're willing to allow our five-year-olds to be exposed to, because it turns out that children are easily confused. And it is kind of confusing if a man or a woman who is dressed as a man walks in the next day and then says that they ought to be treated as a man. This might confuse a small child. I mean, frankly, it confuses most adults. According to the government, this is something the government should force on you. According to the left, the government should force this on you. They should force free institutions, religious or non-religious, into determining how they should hire and fire. That's a violation of individual freedoms. Bottom line, under the Constitution, my values are none of your business. I get to swing my fist in any direction so long as it doesn't hit you in the face. You don't have the right to work at my company. You don't have the right to dictate how my synagogue runs. You don't have the right to tell me how to raise my child so long as I'm not endangering my child. This last area, by the way, is where the left really seeks to kind of insert itself. They try to claim that anything they disagree with is actual damage to the child, which is just absurd. First of all, the left doesn't know my children. The left doesn't care about my children. The left doesn't know my children's names, thank God. Okay, the left does not care about anything having to do with my children. This idea that I care less about my children than folks on the left, and therefore they should decide the social standards by which my child is raised, they can go to hell. That's not a thing that's happening. Another key freedom espoused in the Constitution, freedom of speech and of the press. Now, attempts to restrict freedom of speech on campus are legion. Thank God that didn't happen tonight. Once again, I keep thanking USC because I think that when campuses do the right thing, they ought to be praised. So thank you to USC for doing the right thing. The easiest way to restrict freedom of speech on campus is by claiming that some sort of hate speech has been used, right? I am a purveyor of hate speech. This is what I've been told by the protesters outside. Or they say that I'm somehow microaggressing somebody, which that term in and of itself is so stupid, microaggression. It's such an idiotic term. The idea is that I've performed some sort of minor aggression on you by speaking, and therefore you get to act with macroaggression against me for speaking. Why don't you just say that you don't like what I'm saying and you're a little offended, and then I'll say I don't care, and then we can go about our daily business. Instead, it's how I've been microaggressed. This is hate speech. Let's be clear. There is no constitutional category called hate speech. The reason there is no constitutional category called hate speech is because that which many of us call reasonable speech, the left says is hate speech. They say that a lot of stuff they disagree with is just hate speech. Like, look, let's be real about this. I think that there is certain speech that is fairly objectively hateful. People who use the N-word, right? I think that's objectively hateful. Does that mean it gets to be banned? Even there, I say no. Because the fact is that I don't want the government deciding what speech can and cannot be said. And the constitutional founders agreed with this. They also did not want the government deciding what can and cannot be said, even stuff that I find absolutely vile. Which is why it's weird to me, a lot of protesters outside want to shut down a speech like this, they want to come in and disrupt. I've never wanted to shut down the protesters. I don't care about it. First of all, it's great press for me. Go for it, guys. Now, here's the dirty little secret. The dirty little secret is that identity politics advocates know that I'm not advocating violence, have never advocated violence, and would not advocate violence. So instead what they do is they just redefine my speech as violence. Oh, you said something, and that hurt me. In the words of our former governor, stop whining. And on some occasions, this has actually broken down into violence. Again, I'm glad it didn't happen tonight. At Cal State LA, just down the road, it broke into violence. At Berkeley, obviously, it broke into violence. Once you start labeling speech violence, it's pretty easy to justify to yourself how you can use violence in response to speech. As for freedom of the press, you know, freedom of the press is under attack in a couple of different ways. And I would be remiss here if I didn't mention that the President of the United States is wrong to label the press the enemy of the people. It's a wrong thing to do. The press are not, in fact, the enemy of the people. Okay. The press are biased. In many cases, the press do not tell the truth, as we've seen in the Brett Kavanaugh saga. Don't worry, I'll get to it. But it's also worth noting on this score that the left has this bizarre idea that they get to give special privileges to members of the press and then designate who is a member of the press. Dianne Feinstein actually proposed something like this. She wanted to pass some laws that essentially gave additional privileges to people who were labeled by the government members of the press. That's stupid. Once the government can decide who's a member of the press and therefore restricts First Amendment access to those who are not, that puts the government in charge of restrictions on the First Amendment, which, of course, is a giant fail. Okay, another freedom that is under assault, the freedom of assembly. Okay, you have the right to hang out with people you want to hang out with. It's not the government's responsibility to tell you with whom you choose to assemble, with whom you choose to be politically active, or with whom you choose to do business. The left wants to restrict who goes where based on race. They have affirmative action programs that they want to establish at universities because they say that diversity is good for you inherently. Listen, I have no problem with racial diversity, but if it means that we are going to artificially create racial diversity at the expense of people who are better qualified, then that is something that we call racism. You don't get to do that. It's also worth noting in this context that diversity is mostly useful when it's a diversity of experience and viewpoint. Diversity of race means virtually nothing. It's diversity of experience, viewpoint, how you see the world. That's the stuff that actually matters. And even then, diversity of viewpoint only can work in a context where everybody respects each other's rights. If we can get together and have a conversation, then diversity of viewpoint's great. If diversity of viewpoint includes a guy who is screaming with a bullhorn in your ear in a 3-foot by 3-foot room, then diversity of viewpoint is not so great. We at least have to have a basic agreement on our rights if we're going to have any discussion at all. Hey, folks on the left also try to crack down on campaign finance reform. They suggest that you shouldn't be able to spend money on elections, that corporations shouldn't be able to spend money on elections. Unions should certainly be able to spend money on elections. But corporations should not be able to spend money on elections. Again, it's freedom of association. You get to associate with people you want, and you get to spend your money how you want. And they want to restrict how you do business, as I explained before. Okay, one of the key freedoms that it talks about in the Bill of Rights is the right to bear arms. Obviously, the left does not see it this way. The goal of the right to bear arms, this is the most fundamental of all rights, because the fundamental individual right is your right to protect yourself, your right to protect yourself from violations of your rights, from tyranny. It is the fundamental right. There is no First Amendment without a Second Amendment. Okay, the left seeks to undermine the Second Amendment through rhetorical trickery by suggesting that you have to be a member of a well-trained militia in order to own a gun, which is just a blatant historical misreading. Basically, everybody was a member of a militia back when the Bill of Rights was ratified in 1791. And then they suggest also that you don't need any sort of gun to protect yourself, either in safety terms, which is a weird, I mean, you guys are at USC. Have you walked like 3 blocks from USC? Okay. Or by suggesting that the government is the people, that the government is just, all that the government is just the people. So why would you need a gun to protect yourself against the government? Well, as the history of the world shows, sometimes the government is made up of pretty awful people. There's a reason that some of the first gun control restrictions in the United States were passed specifically by Jim Crow governments in the South attempting to prevent black people from owning firearms. That's because tyrannical governments are very fond of a people that is not armed. I frankly can't understand the left's position on this. At the same time they are arguing that Donald Trump is an incipient Hitler, they're saying, please, Mr. Trump, take all our guns. All right? That's weird. The Constitution protects your right against unreasonable search and seizure. The basic principle here is that the government can't tell you what to do with your home. Now, this has historically been an area where both the right and the left have violated freedoms, because a lot of people want to tell you what to do in your home, or they want to violate your rights. I think the worst case that I've seen recently was this case of a black fellow named Botham Jean in Texas. Now, if you didn't follow this case, it's an awful, awful case. There's a white police officer who I believe was off duty, and she broke into, she thought that she was walking into her own apartment. She walked into Botham Jean's apartment, this I think it was an insurance salesman, this African-American insurance salesman. She walked into his apartment. She thought that he was a criminal in her apartment, and she shot him to death. Okay, and then that's bad enough. Then the police department released the news that Botham Jean had been growing pot in his apartment, as though this justified the wrongful shooting of Botham Jean. That's absurd. The Constitution is supposed to protect against that sort of thing. And when it comes to the stuff that you're doing in your own apartment, so long as it's not affecting anybody else, that's nobody else's business. And this applies whether we are talking about matters sexual, which is what I know everybody on the left wants to talk about. It also matters with regard to how I raise my kid. Again, none of your business. You don't get to decide how I raise my kid, and I promise you, I really don't want to know what you're doing behind that bedroom door. Okay. Finally, we reach the hot button section of the speech, due process of law. So, the British government violated the rights of the colonists without due process of law. They would sort of trump up charges, they wouldn't have proper court procedures, and so the colonists, when they decided to enshrine due process of law in the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution, they decided this was a very, very key thing. Due process is not based on your identity group. Due process is based on you as an individual. You as an individual cannot have your rights removed from you without a due process of law, without a process that is fair and impartial and allows you to confront your accuser. This is due process of law. Botham Jean was entitled to due process of law, and so is Brett Kavanaugh. Brett Kavanaugh is entitled to a presumption of innocence. He is entitled to due process of law. The left has decided that in certain cases, due process isn't necessary. Mob rule will do. And they've certainly decided that with regard to Brett Kavanaugh. Folks on the left, do you want to understand why we're pissed off about the Brett Kavanaugh nomination? I'll be honest with you. When President Trump nominated Kavanaugh, I was lukewarm at best. On my show, I called it a B-minus pick. I said I wanted Amy Coney Barrett. But now, I want Brett Kavanaugh enshrined on the Supreme Court, and I want his, and after he passes, I want his body cryogenically frozen so he can remain on that court forever. And the reason is because you jackasses don't get to do this to people. You don't get to raise uncorroborated allegations and then demand that those allegations be used to destroy somebody's life. I don't know what happened between Brett Kavanaugh and Christine Blasey Ford. You don't either. You don't. You know how I know you don't? Because no one does, other than Christine Blasey Ford and Brett Kavanaugh. There are no witnesses. There's no corroborating evidence. Again, I'm not standing here saying that she lied. I'm not saying that she misled. I don't know. You don't either. You know what that means? That means you don't get to destroy a guy's life based on an allegation alone. And when folks say things like, believe all women, I have a question, why? Really, why? Because I am inclined to believe stories of sexual abuse. I really am. I came out against President Trump when he was running. I didn't vote for him. I came out against Roy Moore, and I actively told people not to vote for Roy Moore in Alabama because there was a lot of corroborating evidence and a bunch of various accounts. Okay, but when folks say believe all women, you can't believe all women any more than you can believe all men or believe any other group of people. And to suggest that women are inherently more believable than men is sexist. To say that men don't deserve the same due process as women is sexist. To suggest that Brett Kavanaugh, because he is white and privileged, does not deserve the same presumption of innocence or due process as someone else is racism and sexism. This is absurd. Okay, Brett Kavanaugh. And it is not a disrespect to women to say that if you want to ruin somebody's life, anybody. I'm not saying that a woman who comes forward and alleges something is by nature ruining somebody's life. I'm saying that an allegation like this ruins somebody's life. It does. Okay, Brett Kavanaugh's life, He's going to be smeared with this the rest of his life. It doesn't matter what happens here on in. He can be on the Supreme Court. That'll be better for him. He cannot be on the Supreme Court. It'll be worse. His life, he will spend the rest of his life being asked whether he tried to rape a girl when he was 17. Okay, that is what it is. But it is certainly not fair for us as a public to go along with the railroading of someone based on an allegation, again, with not a shred of corroborating evidence, nothing, and then say, well, we just have to believe the woman. And the lies that are being told right now are just extraordinary. The lies by the media in this case have been unbelievable. Okay, the lies that there was any corroboration. The lie, my favorite is there are a bunch of columns in the last 2 days, one by Connie Chung, who used to be on NBC and CNN, saying when she was 20, she was sexually assaulted. And she tells the story. It's a terrible story. And then she says, I believe Christine Blasey Ford because I was sexually assaulted. So let me get this straight. You, Connie Chung, were sexually assaulted by a person who is not Brett Kavanaugh, but Brett Kavanaugh is guilty of assaulting a person who is not you, Connie Chung. That's the logic here. And when people say that women don't lie about rape, okay, the truth is, most women, I'm sure, do not lie about rape. But some women do. And some women have bad memories. And some women misidentify. This stuff happens. Witness testimony does make mistakes. This is why we require evidence. If an allegation were sufficient to convict of a crime, we would call that mob rule. That would not be due process of law. And we would hold by it, presumably, with regard to every crime. And the fact that we are now cutting out this one provision of crime because we're in the middle of the Me Too movement, listen, I believe that men shouldn't act like pigs. I've been only advocating this since I was a teenager. I'm the only man in America who was a virgin until I was married and proud of it. And so I've been advocating for a higher standard. I've been advocating for a higher standard of traditional behavior on the part of men, literally my entire public career. But that doesn't mean that you get to carve out a section of crimes that don't require evidence. And here at USC, I guess you guys are really screwing this one up. Not only do all the campuses have these Title IX cases, which are just absurd, I mean, just complete failures of due process, but I was reading about this story, you guys over here, from the Price Women and Allies group, where they sent an email about Brett Kavanaugh saying, quote, we are personally inspired to reiterate the importance of educating and empowering women and allies alike. And then Price School of Public Policy professor James Moore sent an email stating that accusers sometimes lie, which is obviously true. Right, it's funny, Kirsten Power said, well, why can't you name anybody who can lie? Okay, we want to do this again. Tawana Browley, the UVA rape case, the Duke lacrosse case, there's a football player recently who had his life ruined. He went to jail. There are cases where women lie, and there are cases where women don't have enough evidence, lots of cases where women don't have enough evidence. We don't actually have final statistics. They give you a range. They say somewhere between the people who say that women never lie say that 2% of cases of rape are lies or are falsified. The actual range from the study I've seen is anywhere from 2% to 10%, and that does not count all of the cases that are brought to the police, and the police just don't pursue, in which there's just insufficiency of evidence, which is like 45% of all cases that are brought to the police. In any case, James Moore sent an email saying accusers sometimes lie and arguing that maybe we should wait for due process in sexual assault cases. This was a boo-boo. You are not allowed to say this here. This is a very bad thing. So now people want James Moore fired for saying that sometimes accusers lie. Price grad student Kyla Coates wrote, quote, as a female student, I feel very uncomfortable that a male professor whom I have never met is trying to interfere with my access to knowledge about my federal rights. He sent an email. He didn't use a spam blocker, right? This is, what? Okay, and then Moore responded. He said, if you believe the victim, there's really no point in due process. So naturally, students called for him to be fired. Here's USC Annenberg Media reporting, quote, master student Mariana Jordan with USC Price shared how Moore's words are adding to the nation's triggering environment. She said, seeing Mr. Moore's email in my inbox was quite upsetting. You know what's more upsetting than seeing an email in your inbox? When someone accuses you of gang rape without any evidence on the floor of the Senate Judiciary Committee and then suggests in USA Today that you shouldn't be allowed to coach your girls' basketball team anymore and then suggests that because you're a white man, you're not entitled to due process and they should really not be angry about it. If you get angry about any of that, it's because you don't have judicial temperament. It turns out... It is amazing to watch how the goalposts shifted on Kavanaugh. First it was he doesn't deserve to be on the court because he's conservative, which you knew was coming. Then it turned into, and he's really not even that conservative. He's more of a textualist, frankly. And then it turned into, well, he doesn't deserve to be on the court because of the Blasey Ford allegations. And then there's no corroboration for the allegations. And then it's, he doesn't have the judicial temperament necessary because he got mad when you called him a rapist. Which, I mean, that's just such an unbelievable allegation. It's just, it's an incredible allegation. It's like the equivalent. I have a 4.5-year-old daughter and a 2.5-year-old son. It's like my daughter taking my son's hand, slapping him in the face with it a few times, and then going, "Why are you crying? Why are you crying? Why are you so angry?" And he might be angry because you're slapping him in the face with his own hand. It's probably that. Hey, honestly, if I'd been Brett Kavanaugh, like there are very few times in American public life where I wish I were in somebody's shoes for like 5 minutes. I wished that I was in Brett Kavanaugh's shoes for the 5 minutes just to respond to the various senators on that panel. Let me just say for the record that I don't make a habit of cursing publicly. I would never have stopped cursing. You know how it said in his yearbook, something? It would have been like that, except every F would have stood for the exact same word. And they all would have been directed at Dianne Feinstein and Dick Durbin and Corey Potato Head Booker. Okay, other individual rights. The right to life, obviously, is protected by the Constitution of the United States. Under the Fifth Amendment, the right to life is inherent in due process. You cannot be removed of your life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Obviously, the left doesn't care about unborn babies, so we can kill them. But it turns out that the founders probably would have been a little bit upset with the idea of a million unborn babies being killed in the womb so that you can feel like you are exercising your bodily liberty. The abortion argument is always such a weird one to me. It's like, oh, get out of my body. Believe me, I have no interest. Get out of my body. Get your hands off my... It's such an odd argument. Like, I've never talked about your esophagus, right? And by the way, the uterus is not the portion of the body that men find the most attractive, just FYI. So when women are like, oh, get your hands off my uterus... When's the last time even a bad dude went for the uterus? Like, the reason that it turns out that lots of people are interested in your uterus is because there's something inside it, another human. And that human begins its life the minute that it is conceived. And make no mistake, this particular collective positive right, the right to kill an unborn human being out of convenience, that is the real reason the left hates Brett Kavanaugh. It has nothing to do with any of this other stuff. It has to do with they think that Brett Kavanaugh is the fifth vote to overturn Roe v. Wade, and they will stop at nothing to stop him. Fortunately, it looks like they're going to fall short, and I can't stop crying tears of sadness for them. Finally, just stop with this right. There's one more right in the Constitution that's worthy of discussing, and this is one that folks on the left really don't like to talk about, and that is your right to private property. You do have a right to private property in the Constitution. Your property cannot be removed from you without just compensation. What that meant, Richard Epstein has a very good book. He's a law professor at University of Chicago. He has a very good book on this in which he discusses the idea that when the government removes property from you, they have to give you something in return for it. So eminent domain, if they seize your building, they have to pay you for it. And if they seize your tax dollars, they have to give you services in return. Okay, they can't just take your tax dollars and then redistribute them for the sake of restoring income equality. That's not some power that the government was given. And the fact that the left thinks that the government has the power to come into your life, seize your money, depending on how much you make, and give it to somebody else is a violation of your individual rights. So these are all rights that you have. You need to ask yourself, whether you're right, left, or center, if these are rights that you care about, you have the right to hang out with people you want, the right to practice your religion, the right to do business with the people that you want to do business with, the right to earn a living without the government breathing down your neck, the right to have due process of law. If these are rights that you care about, ask who's threatening those rights. And then maybe you'd be better off, instead of protesting outside, thinking about protesting against the folks who had curbed those rights in the first place. Thanks so much. Happy to take your questions. All right, now for the good part.
Okay, everybody, so now we're going to get to the exciting part. If you have questions, you can make your way towards the lobby now. There's going to be ushers there that are going to be directing you where to go. If you disagree with Mr. Shapiro, you get to go to the front of the line. That's his policy. So you're going to be ushered in one at a time. Don't worry about missing out. You are going to be able to hear and see everything. When you get to the front of the line, you're going to be directed right up here, and you're going to stand on the X. I'm standing on it right now. You're going to stand right here. You're going to ask your question, and then you're going to remain on the X and listen to Mr. Shapiro's response. And then there's a couple of rules for the questions. So first of all, we want you to form your question in the form of a question, not a statement. It is a question. All right. Secondly, there is only one question. There's no follow-ups. The only way that you're going to respond is if Ben has a follow-up that he's going to ask you. When you're done with your question, you'll exit back to the lobby right where you came from, this way. And the ushers will take you back to your seat from there. And unfortunately, we probably, looks like a large crowd up there, so we probably won't have enough time to get through everybody, but we will try to get through as many as possible. Okay?
I love you too. Thank you.
Hi, Ben.
Howdy.
So first off, I actually owe you an apology. So I don't know if you remember this, but about a month ago, you were walking down Bedford holding your child on your shoulder, and some guy yelled, "Hey, Ben!" That was me being really overexcited and not expecting to walk into you on the street.
So, it's totally fine. I appreciate it.
Sorry about that. My question is this. So I served in the IDF, and from my experiences
Well, thank you for that.
From my experiences, I saw an issue. I saw this weird recurrence where we would be doing things that would be lawful and legal and also, you know, really nice on purpose because we're aware of these issues. And there would be crazy, like the news would report the exact opposite of what happened. It would be like, you know, some guy stabbed me in the chest and the news would be like, we're just murdering people. It's kind of confusing, but this is my question. We love talking about quantifying data and we're able to gather such immense amounts of knowledge through technology and all these avenues of technology. So why is it that we're not able to solve the issue? I am addressing this specifically for Israel, but why have we not been able to quantify an answer, a solution with all this data that we have? Because we have so much.
Solution to what? Sorry.
A solution to, you know, when they're going crazy and they're saying, when they're straight lying on the news.
Oh, to media bias? Well, I mean, I don't think that it necessarily has to be quantified. I will say that I am grateful to be living in a period where the internet exists. So 27 years ago, the left tried to do something very similar to Clarence Thomas, and Clarence Thomas barely got through. There's no doubt in my mind that if the left had tried to do to Brett Kavanaugh what they did this week to Brett Kavanaugh and last week to Brett Kavanaugh 20 years ago, that Brett Kavanaugh is finished from the get-go. I think that what we are seeing is a dispersion of the means and mechanisms of media, and that is making a serious difference in how people think, but it also is polarizing things. It also means that there are a lot of people who are following sites that are not particularly reliable, and that's something that we, you know, have to try and convince people of.
So is there any effort out there that's trying to balance out the media bias equation?
Yeah, I mean, listen, that's why Daily Wire exists. I mean, I'm happy to say that we've grown enormously.
It works.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that there's a market for truth and for conservative points of view, and we're trying to prove that every day. I mean, I'm hopeful. That's one of the rare areas of American life about which I'm quite hopeful. Is the dispersion of media, but that's going to rely on companies not attempting to crack down on those mechanisms of media. But thank you again for your service in the IDF. My feeling is, by the way, that anybody who serves in an allied government army with the United States is worthy of praise and respect, so thank you for that.
Thank you. Thank you, Ben.
This goes like on a nice little suspense building period as people approach the microphone. He's coming closer to the microphone. He steps up to the putt. I'm just doing color commentary on what you're doing. Go
All
for
right.
it.
Hello, Mr. Shapiro. It's a pleasure to have you here. You're often regarded as a very formidable speaker. and have changed the minds of many with facts and reason. So my question for you is, have you ever had your mind changed on a topic through civil discourse? And if so, what are some of these instances which particularly stand out to you?
Sure. So the two that come to mind particularly, I would say that the issue of marijuana legalization, I've changed my mind on over time. Now, let me make clear that the experiences that changed my mind were not of the sort that you might think. I still think that smoking pot is a complete waste of time, kills brain cells, and is not a good idea as a human. But with all of that said, the data on the efficacy of government regulation of marijuana or criminalization of marijuana demonstrates that it's been basically a giant failure of a program. And so there I think that the data have changed my mind on that issue. Another area where I think that the data have changed my mind somewhat, but not completely, is the area, believe it or not, of global warming. Not that I say that global warming is entirely man-made or that the solution to it is cap and trade, but I think that the data stack up in favor of the idea that the climate is over time getting warmer and also that man does have some sort of impact on it. Now, that, again, doesn't state the solution. This is where it's really funny. There are a lot of folks on the left where I say, yeah, I think global warming is happening. I think that man's activity has something to do with it. And people on the left are like, you're a denier. I'm like, well, wait, what? I didn't deny anything. And they say, well, what, you're a denier because you don't want cap and trade or because you don't want massive, burdensome government regulations. Right, because my preferred solution is technological advancement in this area, as well as investments into infrastructure in different areas of the country, because it turns out the climate has been changing pretty radically over time for the past several billion years, and that human population patterns have been changing for several million years. So that's that's where the disconnect is. But whenever people provide me data, I try to at least think through whether I think that, you know, that should impact my point of view.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. Thanks.
The only person in the room shorter than I am.
Mr. Shapiro, thank you so much for being here, first and foremost. And also, I'm a master's student at Price. Thank you for standing up for Professor Moore.
Absolutely.
Obviously, with the climate. Obviously, in light of everything that's going on at the moment, we all believe rape and sexual assault are heinous crimes. We all want rapists behind bars. But I feel that in this climate, logic, evidence, and data are kind of being lost in translation. And also, there's a very pervasive you're with us or against us mentality that's really doing a lot more harm than good. So my question to you is, how can we best stand up for the importance of due process and the presumption of innocence while also doing what we can to support survivors?
Okay, so I think that there's actually a third question that I want to address that you didn't even ask. So I'll address the first two, and then there's a third one that I think is implicit in the first two. So when it comes to standing up for due process, the answer is that we actually have to stand up for it, even in cases where it makes us uncomfortable, or even where we believe that the person may be responsible for something bad, because once you lose due process for one, you lose due process for everybody, obviously. When it comes to standing up for sexual assault survivors, I think the idea that we ought to take everybody's first account with the respect it deserves means not dismissing, not downplaying, but it also means asking the proper questions in order to get at the truth. That doesn't mean intimidating people. It doesn't mean calling people liars without evidence that they're lying. It doesn't mean mocking them, obviously, God forbid. It doesn't mean doing any of those things. You know, I've throughout the Christine Blasey Ford thing, I keep saying over and over and over, I'm not calling her a liar. I'm not mocking her. I don't know if she's lying. I don't know if she's telling the truth. I don't know if she's misremembering. I don't know any of that stuff. All I know is that due process requires such and such to happen. Now, the real answer in the end to a lot of what's happening, and here's the really unpopular part with the left. The left destroyed traditional mores with regard to relations between the sexes, destroyed them wholesale. So the original idea was that men were supposed to act with honor and chivalry in protecting women, and women were supposed to look for example, relationships just as men were. Sexual activity was supposed to be confined, this was at least the ideal, was supposed to be confined to committed relationships, particularly marriage. Not everybody lived up to that, but a huge number of people did. In fact, once people got pregnant, people basically got married. There are studies from the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s shows an awful lot of 7-month marriage babies, right? People who are sleeping together, getting pregnant, and then the couple gets married. When you don't teach men to protect women, you get men who will victimize women. And when you don't teach women that they ought to cherish men who are responsible and good, all you end up doing is incentivizing bad male behavior. The feminist movement was not wrong when they said men are acting like pigs. They were wrong when they said women also ought to act like pigs and that this is a solution to our problem. Because the reverse, because now what's happened is they got rid of all the traditional mores about how sex ought to be connected with love and ought to be connected with relationships. They got rid of all of that. It was just a bodily function now. Except when it comes to actual sexual assault, we treat that differently than any other bodily function, obviously. But that's the problem, right? So they create the standard where sex is basically a throwaway item, sort of like eating. And then we treat sex very differently when it comes to what we all know it is, which is a deeply important and intimate part of a person's life, and then we attempt to backdoor standards of consent that, frankly, don't make any sense in a real-life context. So you get college campuses in California saying that what you need is a yes-means-yes standard, where you have like a legal checklist, I guess, where every time you do anything in the bedroom, you're supposed to ask, am I allowed to touch your hand? Am I allowed to touch your shoulder? Am I allowed to touch your hair? Which has never, ever resulted in actual fulfillment of a sexual encounter. Right, I mean, it's sort of like, it's like Zeno's paradox. If you have a yes means yes standard, the closer you get, the further away you are. And again, sex is this is where women really gave up on marriage a lot too soon. Okay, marriage was the best thing ever for women. It is an amazing an amazing thing for men too, because it civilizes them, it cultures them, it teaches them to be protectors of their family and to take care of people and to think beyond themselves and to think beyond their generation. Women gave up in marriage a way to teach men to do those things. And also, women gave up the idea that a commitment was going to come along with this intimacy. And let's be real about this. I mean, every scientific study ever done has shown that women actually do have better sex in the context of committed relationships. All of the crap that you see in Cosmo magazine about sleeping with 100 guys and being sexually happy is just garbage. It is just sheer unadulterated garbage. No, long answer to a short question, but reinculcation of traditional roles of male and female with the same feminist respect that we ought to have for women at all steps of the process is the answer.
Thank you. I hope people are listening.
Good evening, Mr. Shapiro.
Hey, how's it going?
You said earlier that affirmative action as a policy is racist, correct?
Yes.
So, based on previous Supreme Court rulings, race can only be used as a deciding factor between two equally qualified students. Given this premise, how is it racist to attempt to try to increase the access of minorities in colleges, given that even with affirmative action, they are still underrepresented?
Because that's not actually how affirmative action is done. So what the colleges have done is they've come up with end-arounds. So what they do is they have, for example, essay portions of the application. It's not based on scores, which are objective, or GPA, which is objective. It's based on the essay that you write, and this is why what you see is that at Ivy League schools, the average SAT that is required for a minority student is significantly lower than the average SAT that's required of another minority student, namely Asians. Right? They've had the serious problem at Harvard and Harvard Law School, a problem where too many Asians were getting in, which in my view is not a problem, but in the view of the people at Harvard was a problem. It's not a problem for me because I'm not a racist. It's a problem for them because they are. But they think that, two things. One, I think that if you have two people who are equally qualified, but one had to overcome more barriers, more life barriers, then sure, let the person who had to overcome more life barriers in. But I don't think that race is necessarily a stand-in for life barriers. This is the other part of the story. I don't think that everyone is equally situated, and I don't like group identity politics. And what I mean by that is that Colin Powell's son had to overcome fewer life obstacles, I would assume, than you. Right? Because Colin Powell's son probably had to overcome fewer life obstacles than pretty much anyone. Right? I mean, he grew up wealthy, his father is well-respected, right? There are plenty of middle-class and upper-class black folks in this country, contrary to popular opinion, and their kids grew up in relatively decent circumstances or privileged circumstances. That has nothing to do with race. So if you want to say that somebody's life experience has required them to overcome something, I don't agree with the basic premise, which is that you are inherently behind the eight ball based on your race. You may be behind the eight ball based on the area where you live, or based on the fact that you grew up in a single-mother home, or based on your level of poverty, or based on an actual experience with racism that you can talk about. But you don't just get to say that because my skin is a different shade than yours, that I deserve to get a slot that you don't get, especially if it means that I scored lower than you did.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks. Hey, how's it going?
Hi. So you have given a number of speeches about the difference between opportunity and outcome, and you say that our country has no lack of opportunity, correct?
Equal access to rights, I think, right, would be the better way to state it, yeah.
Oh, okay. So equal, I'm saying, okay.
Equal access to the exercise of rights. So you're correct that I've said opportunity before, and it's not exact enough, so I'm modifying it now.
Okay.
Because when I say, because obviously, not to forecast where this conversation is going to go, but I have a feeling where you're going to go, and you can correct me if I'm wrong. I'll give you plenty of time. Is that what you're going to say is that not everybody has equal opportunity, which, of course, is true. Not everybody. Some people are rich. Some people are poor. Some people are smart. Some people are stupid. But everyone does have equal access to rights.
No. Okay. For sure. Okay. So my... question was really just around, you know, when we look at housing discrimination and just access to capital, right, as being one of the limiters of access to opportunity, right? When we look at MUD loans coming from Wells Fargo loans for MUD people, right, in Baltimore, you know, having less access to viable capital, right? Not having predatory lending practices against people for certain demographics or red line districts, right? And so when we talk about equality of opportunity, right? That's kind of where I base my argument.
Right.
Like, I'm not necessarily talking about rights. I'm talking about
right.
as we like move through society where implicit bias plays in. I just don't necessarily
There's a lot there.
Right.
Why don't I start with the implicit bias point, because I think the implicit bias point is the easiest to talk about, and then I'll get to the rest of the main points.
Sure.
I know that was kind of ancillary. The implicit bias point, it's something I don't buy just because implicit bias assessments are scientifically unstable. There's been a lot of writing about this. When people take IAT tests, the implicit assessment tests,
right.
These things are not scientifically good measurements by any stretch of the imagination, and there's no actual data showing linkage between how you do on those stupid computer clicking tests and you being a racist in real life.
Well,
but
I mean,
let's get... But,
wait, doesn't Harvard have that study, though, that actually linked the diagnosis of, like, blood clots in the brain and how... people that had a higher implicit bias, I agree with you. At some point, it's not necessarily the most scientific thing. It's a burgeoning science.
Well, it's...
But I'm not quite done yet. So they had this study, and they pretty much concluded that if you had a higher implicit bias, you were less likely to prescribe the correct medicine for a black person because you didn't believe their pain. So that definitely...
I'd have to look at that specific study.
Yeah, I can quote it for you
I'm happy to have you read a full study to me, but you have a beautiful speaking voice. But with that said, Jesse Singel has a very, very long piece in New York Magazine specifically talking about all the flaws in the implicit bias assessment tests, mm-hmm. and the fact that there's really no way to untrain implicit bias is actually the bigger point, is that all the measures of attempting to erase this through implicit bias training are a giant fail. So when Starbucks did that, it didn't actually do anything, for example.
Right.
But I want to get to the main point, because that was actually sort of an ancillary point,
mm-hmm.
and then if you want, we can go back to that other one. The main point that you're making, which is that there are certain people who are discriminated against, is obviously something that is true. It is also true that we have to, as a society, look at what is the best and least restrictive way of ensuring that people are able to exercise opportunity. So what I would say is that in cases, first of all, I would say that a lot of the redlining scandals were actually miscovered by the media. There were some cases, as you mentioned, you know, the email exchanges with regard to quote-unquote MUD people that demonstrate actual racial animus, and these companies paid enormous settlements on the basis of all of that.
Right.
With that said, it is my view that if somebody is a good loan risk, there are plenty of companies that are willing to give them loans. It turns out that white companies were giving loans at a higher rate to Asians than they were to whites. Okay, so it wasn't that these companies, were like Wells Fargo, were discriminating against black people versus everyone else. They were they were ranking races, which was not—it's not a good practice, obviously, and it's not something we want to see. It's a practice that I think can be solved with more competition in the mortgage market. Like the here's what I'm trying to say to you, I guess.
So you're saying banks of wider diversity.
Well, what I'm saying is banks that have more access to data based on loan giving. Mm-hmm. So I'm willing to if I see a person in front of me and I think that they're a good risk, and you see a person in front of you and you think that they're a bad risk, but only because of the color of their skin, I'm going to make more money than you if the person is in fact a good risk. That's right. True. So my goal here is a broader creation of information. So I'll give you an example. One of the things that Barack Obama tried to do in his latter years in office was prevent employers from looking at the criminal histories of people that they were trying to employ. This was actually a bad idea. The reason this was a bad idea is because what employers began doing, and it was bad policy, is they began trying to use group characteristics as a judgment call. So what they would say is, okay, the criminal conviction rate in the black community is higher than the criminal conviction rate in the white community. I don't know whether this person sitting in front of me is a criminal or not, but I know that there is a higher rate of criminality in this particular community, so I won't hire him. You know what would solve that? Not railing about racism. What would actually solve that is getting rid of the law so you can look at this guy's actual criminal record and determine whether he's a criminal or not. If he's not a criminal, you're discriminating against him based on race. If he is a criminal, then maybe you're right not to hire him in the first place. So more information is a solution in a market economy to lack of opportunity, not kind of generalized railing at the ether or suggesting that racism is the inherent barrier. More information, more competition, that's the answer. And when we see somebody who's doing something racist, I think that we're all on the same page. We'd like to call them out.
Definitely. Oh, also, the study is called Implicit Bias Among Physicians and Its Prediction of Thrombolysis Decisions of Black and White Patients.
Okay, I'll check it out. Can you email it to me? That'd be awesome. Can you? My email address is bshapiro@dailywire.com. Just send it to me right now. I'd like to check it out.
Bshapiro at what?
bshapiro@dailywire.com.
Daily Wire. All right.
Thanks.
Hello, Mr. Shapiro. I just want to say thank you for coming out tonight. Thank you. When I break down my beliefs, I don't consider myself conservative, but on the flip side, I don't consider myself a leftist. I consider myself more like an old-school classic liberal, and seeing what's kind of going on with the left recently, it's really insulting that leftists have kind of appropriated the term liberal, because a lot of what they were spouting goes against traditional liberal ideas like freedom of speech and the defending of individual liberty. So my question is, as an old school classic liberal, what is your advice to traditional liberals who have been alienated by leftist and progressive ideas?
I mean, I'd say look for people to look for new people to associate with, frankly. I mean, this is why you'll notice in my speeches and in all of my talks, I make this exact distinction, right? I always talk about what the left is doing. The left and liberals are not the exact same folks. Right, the left are people who actually do want to shut down free speech. Liberals are people who disagree with me on the level of government spending in the economy and government regulation, but agree with me on basic principles with regard to free speech and free exchange of ideas. And one of the things that I've been involved with in the last couple of years is something that's sort of been informally termed the intellectual dark web, and that's because I'm the only registered Republican in the group so far as I know. And everybody else in the group, I mean, it's people like Sam Harris and Brett Weinstein and Eric Weinstein and Barry Weiss would probably be a charter member. Joe Rogan, obviously, is a member. Jordan Peterson. Yeah. All these people disagree on virtually everything, but what we do agree on is the value of exchange. And the thing that really unifies this group is hatred of identity politics and hatred of the left's censorious attempts to prevent debate. So find people to talk to who are not on the left and maybe recognize that certain leftist values with regard to collectivism and collective rights and positive rights trumping individual rights tend to shade into actual tyrannical attempts to control other people. I do think that there is a connection between liberalism politically and leftism in terms of censoriousness, but it's a shading. You don't have to move over that line, but it's a lot easier to move from that line to over that line than from libertarian, for example, over toward censoring.
I just wanted to say thank you. That was fantastic advice, and I agree with a lot of your points, so thank you very much.
Well, thanks so much.
Hi, Ben.
Hey.
So you've come out against the rioters in Charlottesville and all their violence and bigotry.
Yep.
The leaders of the Charlottesville rally were empowered by the rhetoric and agenda of Donald Trump and a lot of his associates, as they've come out in the Vice documentary and claimed. You've not only said controversial things, but you've had a couple of attacks against the trans community, transphobic attacks, even your call for the transfer of Palestinians, which I don't know if you've redacted that.
Yeah, I redacted that like eight, nine years ago.
I just wanted to make sure. I wanted to ask you. No, I'm just learning about Ben.
No, that's fine. That's fine.
But even with that, do you feel that a lot of your speech could incite the same kind of violence?
I mean, you heard my speech tonight. Do you feel that my speech could incite violence?
Well,
I mean that seriously. That's an honest question.
I know you're asking honestly. I feel that it, for me as an individual, it isn't. But I could see how a lot of your points I really disagreed with. I literally have a list of questions.
And that's fine. I mean, that's the good part, right? Where we disagree and we can have a conversation.
I just was wondering in terms of you, and what I mean by inciting violence is encouraging the same people who believe in like your transphobic beliefs. Even that, like, homophobia is a sin based on your religious beliefs. Do you believe that because of what you say, you can encourage a lot of people to act on those beliefs?
So I have a very strong standard with regard to incitement, and I'm very consistent about this. If I'm not telling somebody to commit violence, I'm not inciting them to violence. I've held the standard for Barack Obama when he was saying anti-police things, and then somebody went and shot up some police officers in Dallas. I said, that's not Barack Obama's fault. When a Bernie Sanders supporter went and shot up a congressional baseball game, I said, that's not Bernie Sanders' fault because Bernie Sanders wasn't calling for that. Political debate requires that you talk to people and people take your words as what they mean, not as an excuse to go and do violence. I've never called for violence, nor would I. As far as the idea that my words are some sort of attack, a violent attack, for example, on folks who are transgender, I'm responding to the people who are not you who might say that. Okay. So the idea that I am transphobic, for example, this is a bizarre kind of attack in the sense that I don't know that I've ever exhibited phobia of trans people. I'm not afraid of trans people.
Transphobia is more along the lines of prejudice against the trans.
I actually think that your first characterization was right. I think that transphobia is really disagreement with the basic principle that the trans community is trying to purvey, which is that people's sex is malleable. That people can move from male to female, and that it is my job, objectively, to now call them the name they wish to be called, and to teach my children that men can be women and women can be men. I fundamentally disagree with that point. Now, with that said, is everybody in the United States entitled to the same rights? Of course. But your right does not extend to forcing me to call you what you want me to call you. That's not the way this works. That violates my freedom of speech. So, in interpersonal relationships, if I were out to dinner with a trans person, would I make a point of noting their proper biological sex? No, because that would be impolite. When I'm talking about the general principle of is a man a woman or is a woman a man, the answer is I will say that a man is a man and a woman is a woman and a he is a he and a she is a she. And if I'm in a public debate with somebody, I will say the same thing.
I do want to clarify that when I meant, I wasn't trying to say disagreement. I was relating it to the same definition of homophobia, which is discrimination.
Right. So I think that, again, homophobia, there are some people who actively want to do violence to people who are gay, right? I mean, those people are not me or anybody that I agree with, obviously. I've never at any point in my entire career ever advocated violence, God forbid, against anybody in a civilized society. That's not something that I believe in, and I think it's evil. I think, again, your original definition of transphobia actually is better applied here as well. I think it's disagreement with certain principles that the homosexual community wishes to espouse.
What I was saying was that's not what I was I'm saying that I agree with your original definition
and not your definition. So the definition that you made, I'm not saying it's mine.
It's one that I like Googled that I found.
Right. So, and I think that definition is wrong, and I think that the one that you Freudian slipped was right. I'm saying
based on like the institution of, I don't want to say the institution of Google because that's an extremely general thing to say, but in terms of as soon as you search transphobia, homophobia, this is what comes up.
Right, and I think
do you feel like even though you're disagreeing with transphobia, with the trans community, which I believe we all have our own disagreements, I'm asking, do you feel that the fact that with your disagreement, you're inherently through the institutions that have provided these definitions, discriminating against trans community.
And I'm saying, I, so I'm saying
thus
I,
encouraging so, other people
right.
to follow.
So
I know
here's
it's a
what,
long
so,
question, but
right.
I had to
That's
encapsulate a lot of
so
things.
So here's what I'm saying. I disagree with either their definition is wrong or it's overly broad in its application.
Okay.
So if the idea is that if I say a man is a man and a woman is inherently transphobic, mm-hmm. that's not discrimination, that's disagreement. If they say that's discrimination, they're overly applying
well,
their
well,
own
Well, I
label.
Think when you say, like, they're mentally ill, like, that
well,
gives off...
I have said, and I will continue to maintain, mm-hmm. that gender dysphoria or gender identity disorder, whichever DSM you choose to use, is a mental illness. Mm-hmm. That is... And that... And again... God forbid that it should be said with any animus, because this is not said with animus. When people are suffering, these are clearly folks who are suffering. When people are suffering, you shouldn't be saying stuff with animus. I'm not saying that as a gotcha to people who are transgender. The point that I'm making is that when a society begins treating folks who have mental illness as though they are representing an objective reality, they are doing no service to the people who actually suffer from a mental illness. My grandfather suffered from schizophrenia, paranoid schizophrenia. He was institutionalized. If the doctors had said to him, Nate, you're fine. We believe that the radio is actually talking to you. That is not a service to him. That would have been terrible for him. Mm-hmm. Right? They put him in an institution. They gave him lithium, and it helped. Now, I'm not saying there's even a great solution for folks who have gender identity disorder or gender dysphoria, because the solutions that I've seen, including transgender surgery, are not intensely effective from all the studies that I've seen. It's a tragic, tragic situation. But the solution is not to redefine as a society what sex means along anti-biological lines. As far as the homophobia point, it's my own religious belief about the sinful nature of particular people's behavior should have no impact on how you act in a free country or how you think. It's a free country. Do what the hell you want. Right? There's religious Ben, which is what I think is sinful, which is Jews who violate Sabbath, mm-hmm. right? Jews who eat shellfish. Right? There's a lot of things that we think are sinful in right. Judaism. Right? And then there's the stuff where do what you want because it's a free country. I think people do a lot of sinful stuff all the time, and I'm not calling them on it. Right? I think the people who are living together outside of marriage are sinning according to my traditional religious beliefs. Mm-hmm. It's a free country. Do what you want. Mm-hmm. So when people say homophobia, I think what they are doing is saying you disagree with me. I've never called for violence, and not only that, I'm in favor of legalization of same-sex marriage in the sense I want the government completely out of marriage, right? I don't want the government in the marriage business at all. So it's very... So I think that what bothers me is when folks assume that a disagreement means that they can ascribe animus, anger, hatred, mm-hmm. wish for violence to me.
Which is what a lot of the Charlottesville rioters were doing.
Well, the Charlottesville rioters were garbage people. I mean, I did two full episodes
well,
on how garbage the Charlottesville rioters
yeah.
were.
I mean, this has been really great, actually, to have this yeah. dialogue. But I think... What?
I was the number one target of the alt-right in 2016, according
no,
to the Anti-Defamation League.
I looked you up. Yeah, yeah, I know. But what I and I'm sorry, I don't mean to be sassy, but what I really wanted to understand was because you have such a large platform, I mean, even through Twitter, through social media, through your website, through your just all your work, like, do you not claim... I don't know of any particular cases where someone has said Ben Shapiro told me to literally go murder a trans person or someone who...
And if they did,
something.
They would be lying.
Right. Yeah, okay. I just wanted to, like, ask you about...
Right. And if they did, they would be lying. And I would think that, and again, anybody who commits acts of violence or evil mm-hmm. in my name is a violent, evil person.
Okay.
And I hope that's standard for everyone. But I really appreciate you coming out.
Thank
it really
you.
Means a lot to me. Thank you.
Okay, so this next question is going to be our last question. I know.
I'm sorry about it. These questions are great. Sorry for the long answers. The questions are really good tonight.
Hello, Ben.
Hey, how's it going?
If you find aborting a baby for convenience morally wrong, then wouldn't eating meat conflict with the moral value of not killing life for convenience?
So this is actually, honestly, this is a great question and something that I've been actually considering myself. There are very few issues where I think that in 100 years people are going to look back at us and go, what were they doing? Abortion is obviously one. I've honestly considered the possibility of vegetarianism or veganism on these grounds. I really have. The only thing that prevents me from doing it really is that there are still nutritional benefits to be gained from eating meat that would be hard to duplicate in a vegetarian or vegan diet.
Like
but
what?
Protein like what? Meat protein is useful. But it's but that said, it's some I will say. That I think someone could make me a convincing case. I think I could be convinced on it.
Thanks.
Yeah, can we do one more? Because that was short. Can we do one more? One more? Okay, we have one more? righty, we'll pull him out from the... Here he comes. The last question. Okay. Hey, how's it going?
Hey there. Hi. So you had this great discussion with Sam Harris on your show.
Yeah.
And Harris raised an issue in the relationship between ignoring certain doctrinal text, right, and yet still believing in ideas like revelation. Right?
Yes.
My question is, if you truly believe in the supernatural side of monotheism, why is it okay to perform, as you described in Judaism, an ongoing dialectic?
Yes.
Right? Over time and pick and believe only certain pieces of doctrine when you realize, oh, wait, the original parts we're omitting were directly from an omniscient being.
Right. Okay, so
then, how do you get your mind around
that? Sure. So the answer that I gave Sam Harris is that the omniscient being, in this case God, gave the perspective of Judaism has always been. The omniscient being gave us flawed human beings this book. This book was directed at a certain time and at a certain place, right? The people who were living 3,000 years ago didn't have the same education and values, the same evidence, the same scientific knowledge, the same 3,000 years of development we've had since Sinai. And so God was talking to specific people at a specific time. So a lot of the commandments are specifically directed at converting people away from more primitive practices toward less primitive practices. So to take an example, animal sacrifices are now, we look at them, we go, that's really primitive. That's pretty terrible, right? So the idea that Maimonides puts this forth, and he's writing this in 1100, the idea that Maimonides puts forth is that there were pagan practices in which animals were slaughtered on behalf of pagan gods, and the idea was that you were sort of appeasing these gods, and that this was supposed to be, and that this was the use of animal sacrifices for perverse purposes. People weren't willing to give up those perverse purposes at the time. God knew that, and so God converted the use of those purposes to the worship of him, for example. And then we have to apply, this is where Judaism is really an interesting religion, not to stump for my own religion, but I'm a fan. The part of Judaism that makes it so interesting is that Judaism doesn't just say that we were given revelation at Sinai on the written side. It says there was also something called the oral Torah, the Mishnah. Okay, and that was the explanation that people had of the Torah at the time, meaning that there's an entire common law tradition in Judaism that stretches directly from Sinai and is codified in the Talmud, which is written 700 CE, 500, 700 CE, and it's legitimately like 73 volumes of commentary on the written Torah. Like, I study it every day, actually. Here's the point. God didn't just say to human beings, here's the law, I mean exactly what I say forever on these areas without regard to what human beings are. God injected an enzyme into human development. That enzyme was, in my view, revelation. And without that enzyme, there is no catalyst for Western civilization. There are certain principles that are different in Western civilization than in other places in the world. And human beings, using their reason and logic, get to apply eternal principles to new circumstances and new evidence over time. The question Sam never answered is, why here? Why is the West so great? So Sam if revelation is all just bunk, right? If it's all just evolutionary development of the minds and searching for the most, most flourishing for the most people and all this stuff, then why is Western civilization different? Because it obviously and eminently is quite different.
Right, the Judeo-Christian ethic argument, right?
Right.
But I'm trying to focus more on the spirituality side because it seems like you acknowledged, right, there are parts that you're leaving out in even your beliefs, right? Most modern Judeo-Christian...
Well, there are parts that are directed at changing human nature, and there are parts that are directed at unchanging human nature.
Would you argue, though, that so your argument is that essentially this deity put in parts and essentially duped us? Said, okay, you can leave those out eventually.
No, my argument is that anything I say to you right now as a human being inherently is going to be different than it would be if I had directed it to your descendants 2,000 years in the future, because that's how human language works. There is no way to convey a written document or language to any human being without being confined by the context of the time in which people live. That's true of any document, it's true of any conversation. You literally cannot do it any other way. So I'm not sure, like, you're asking of God an impossibility, which is to give a moral system that is completely unfit for a people at the time that he gave it. If God gave us the Torah now, I assume that it would look a lot more like the development of Western civilization than it did when it was given to a bunch of primitives, yeah. primitive nomads living in the desert.
Yeah. I don't doubt your argument about developing our morals. I totally yeah. agree with that. What I'm doubting is the idea of a deity, believing in literally
right.
God.
Right, and the argument for a deity and the argument for revelation is a long one. I have an entire book coming out about it next year. But the basic idea is that Sam uses all the building blocks of Western civilization that are based on a Judeo-Christian value system and revelation and a God that exists outside of time and a directional nature to the creation of the world, a logic to the nature of the world. He uses all those arguments, gets rid of God, and then expects the edifice not to crumble. And I don't think it's possible to uphold that edifice without those foundational building blocks that include the idea of an ordered universe created by a loving God.
Thank you.
Thanks. Well, thank you all so much. I really appreciate it. Thanks for coming out.